Ladies and gentlemen, a acquaintance of mine took a trip to the West. He was from Cleveland. Took his trip not long after the second of the big riots there. So as he went west along Route 66, he got to Albuquerque. And he asked the innkeeper where he stayed, do you have any racial difficulties here? The innkeeper said, well, you know, it's a funny thing. We used to have quite a number of colored people here. They were all on payments from the federal government, of course. But about a year ago, they got into their Cadillacs and their Lincolns and they drove off. And we haven't seen any since. So the man was naturally interested and he drove on down the highway. His next stop, of course, was Santa Fe. He looked around there and asked the same question. They got the same reply. About a year before, they'd gotten into their Lincolns and their Cadillacs, and they drove off west. And they said something about Route 184, but nobody knew where Route 184 was. So the man drove on west, and he got to Flagstaff. Flagstaff, he was told, yes, about a year ago, great caravans of Lincolns and Cadillacs came through town. They were looking for Route 184. Haven't seen them since. So he drove on. Pretty soon he came to a little sign which said Route 184. He looked at it. It was just a very short road, about half a mile long, paved, ran from the highway, straight north, right to the brink of the Grand Canyon. Then he noticed there was a big sign over it, reserved for white people only. Ladies and gentlemen, I am indeed honored that you have asked me to address you once again, and I am proud to participate in your 16th annual convention. 16 years is a long time. As patriotic organizations come and go in the United States, and much has happened since your first meeting, which I did not attend. If I remember correctly, it was strictly in the capacity of an observer, and at the suggestion of the late George S. Montgomery, that I first attended a Congress of Freedom. That was out in San Francisco 12 years ago. And if I am not mistaken, it was at that very time that one of your founders, Mr. George J. Thomas, became your executive secretary and the very heart and soul of this organization, which he has ever since directed with a selfless dedication and a noble constancy of purpose for which we Americans can never be sufficiently grateful. I had the privilege of addressing you first, as I remember, in Colorado Springs in 1959, and even that is a long time ago. Much has happened since. Our prospects have changed almost kaleidoscopically. Our hopes have risen and fallen. The outlook in 1959 was grim indeed, and the prospect at that time was that given the strange apathy that had fallen on the American people since our enemies struck down Senator Joseph McCarthy, a complete communist takeover of the United States was entirely possible by 1963 and could well have occurred at that time. Of course, it did not. We who are in this room, and the men and women who were our associates then, but have since traveled to that bourne whence none return, and the comparatively small bands of Americans who were equally aware of what was happening, we successfully fought a delaying action. We did not by any means break the narcotized apathy of our people, but we did succeed in inducing some faint tremors of apprehension. We, against almost overwhelming odds, exposed the means by which the Washington, New York, Moscow axis had installed submarine and missile bases 90 miles from our shores. And later, when the Cubans had been again betrayed at the infamous Bay of Pigs, we exposed the Entente Cordiale between Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro. We exposed, among other things, the treason whereby American fighting planes and other military equipment were being covertly given to the Soviet. That stirred a small but yet considerable fraction of the population. For a while, it seemed even probable that our delaying action might become something more, that for the first time since patriotic Americans began to organize in 1920, we could do more than hamper and delay our enemy's advance, that for the first time we could force them to retreat so that we could recover at least a little of our lost ground. You all remember the series of indignation conventions throughout the nation. I shall never forget the feeling that comes from the emotional unanimity of a large audience, from the inexplicable but unmistakable emanation that becomes palpable when the current of a single purpose flows through many minds. That electrical charge in the atmosphere was proof that that audience of 6,000 Americans was united in thought, was united in anger, was united in the high resolve that Major Knickerbocker had expressed in one clear phrase: "They shall not go unpunished." There was indeed so clear a possibility that they would not go unpunished that our foes used a major tactical device which they held in reserve for major emergencies. They arranged for the assassination of Jack Kennedy, and although there was one little hitch in the operation itself and a blunder that had to be covered up by prompt action on the part of Jacob Rubinstein and Earl Warren, they gained a great victory. They staged the greatest theatrical spectacle that the nation had seen since David Wark Griffith's Fall of Babylon or Cecil B. DeMille's Ben-Hur. With the aid of an Army Corps that had been diligently rehearsed for the occasion and a large cast, including that talented young actress Jacqueline Kennedy, they incited in the vast public that sat staring at the boob tubes hour after hour an orgy of mindless emotionalism, worthy of a tribe of Hottentots or Zulus bewailing an eclipse of the moon or the loss of their big chief. Thus were we defeated, perhaps decisively. It was more than a defeat. It was a rout, as some of our loudest and presumably boldest champions ran desperately for cover and were last seen either cowering flat on their faces in the bushes or down on their knees protesting that they hadn't meant a word of what they had said the day before and that no one could worship St. Jack more than they did. It took us more than a year to reform our thin and depleted lines, and in all the subsequent time we have not been able to offer really effective opposition to the invaders and their mercenaries. Our fairly strong defensive positions, built up with so much effort and sacrifice, were lost in November 1963. And since that time, we have been retreating, sometimes faster, sometimes a little more slowly, but always retreating. And now we have reached the point at which we can retreat no farther. We have reached the very verge of a precipice. Our situation is so desperate that I am going to speak bluntly, very bluntly. Since this is an afternoon meeting, and except for the inevitable spy or two, all of you must be veterans of the Congress of Freedom and other conservative organizations, and you do not need to be convinced or reminded of what has happened to these United States. I want to examine with you the very limited fields of action that still remain open to us. I intend to point out to the best of my ability those limitations, for no one can plan a strategy without first measuring his own resources and noting above all where his forces are weakest and his position most vulnerable. Such an examination must always be unpleasant, must frequently be painful, and must sometimes be profoundly discouraging. In 1960, I attended a conference of nine writers for and editors of conservative periodicals that had been called by an American businessman in the chimerical hope that we could work out some sort of coordinated anti-communist strategy. My contribution to the discussion was eventually published in Modern Age as an article entitled Conservatism and Reality, which I am told was reprinted and rather widely circulated. Some of you may have seen it. I shall start from that point today with allowance for all that has happened in the years that have intervened. I shall assume that in this dark and ominous year, 1967, it is much more important to find, if we can, some means of saving our lives and our country than it is to quarrel over the abstractions of philosophy or the intuitive certainties of faith. And I shall further assume that we are willing to consider questions of strategy and tactics as objectively and as cold-bloodedly as a military commander tries to estimate what he can in any way accomplish with the forces at his disposal. We who are here today are Americans, but we form no very large number, even if we add the total membership of the various organizations that you represent. Obviously, our only chance of success depends on our ability to enlist actively on our side a very considerable number of our fellow Americans. The very first thing that we should do is reflect very earnestly and with the utmost objectivity on the character of the very peculiar race to which we belong. We are the creators of exact science and technology, but we are also the creators of the world's most romantic literature. We differ so profoundly from all other races in so many ways that it would take all the rest of this hour merely to suggest the most striking differences. So I must pass over this very fundamental consideration with only the very earnest recommendation that you study our peculiarities, our strengths, and above all, our weaknesses as a race for yourselves, and then ponder them well before you decide on any strategy. Our problem is how to create a consensus, an emotional consensus, in a very considerable segment of our population. And if we are to save our lives and those of our fellow Americans, we must create that consensus very quickly, for our time is almost run out. It is obvious that there are only two means by which Americans can recapture the United States. It must be done by action, and there are just two kinds of action: armed resistance and political effort. In the past, Americans have tried armed resistance twice, once successfully and once with tragic failure. In the first war for independence fought on the soil of this continent, the 13 British colonies, with the indispensable aid of the King of France, succeeded in establishing their independence. In the second instance, the Confederacy fought alone for the right of self-government and failed. Now, I do not wish to discuss the possibilities of violent action at this time, even as a theoretical problem, for that would entail long and involved considerations of the very significant changes in military equipment and organization that have occurred during the past century, and the equally important differences in the nature of our enemies. It will suffice to note here that armed resistance is possible only where there is an effective consensus. At the time of the First War for Independence, there were in all the 13 colonies many Tories, as they were called, and they were a considerable and influential part of the population, but they were overawed, silenced, and expelled, always illegally, often with gross injustice, and sometimes with brutality that we like to forget. Kenneth Roberts' Oliver Wiswell is a fairly accurate description of what happened. And I know that the book makes indignant the nice ladies who want to believe that what the Boston Tea Party was noteworthy for was the hostess's politeness in insisting that each of her guests have 2 lumps of sugar in her tea. That's not quite right. But it was by such illegal and often deplorable means that the founders of this nation obtained the effective consensus that made the war for independence possible. But it was a limited consensus. Note, please, it was a limited consensus. The only agreement, really, was that the colony should be independent of Great Britain. There was every kind of diversity, matters of religion, and matters of what you may term social philosophy, in economics, in economic interest. The economic interests of one colony were often diametrically opposed to those of another colony. Diametrical differences in social organization and social values. There was just one consensus, and that was for independence. For political action, the need for an effective consensus is even more obvious. It is not we, the 100 or so people assembled in this room, nor yet the 5 or 10,000 whom you may be able to lead as members of the organizations that you represent, who constitute a political force worth considering. To win anything, we shall have to arouse and inspire in one way or another a majority of the actual voters in a majority of the states. To what force or forces, then, can we effectively appeal? How can we mobilize on our side in this desperate struggle enough men and women and mobilize them in time? I am sure that the first thing that occurs to all of us is Christianity. Now, I know that by speaking of it, I am treading on very dangerous ground, and that I risk antagonizing almost everyone. But I am going to assume that we are responsible people, that our concern here is not with what ought to be true, but what is in fact true at the present time, that we are trying to appraise realistically our strength and our weakness. And I emphatically remind you that, as is my invariable custom, I shall not express, either explicitly or by implication, any opinion on any matter of theology or faith. It would be easy for me to prove historically that since the 5th century, Western civilization has been a Christian civilization, and that the United States are historically a Christian nation. But what are they now? So far as one can tell from the statistics in the yearbooks, about half the population is Christian in the sense that many persons have been counted as members by one denomination or another. But that means nothing. Some of those persons have never attended a church since they were baptized or married. A great many attend the Sunday morning clubs because they think it's the thing to do or because they have nothing else to do. I need not remind the Protestants present how large a part of the Protestant churches have been taken over by the sleek atheists of the National Council, who cynically use their pulpits to manipulate for subversive and revolutionary purposes their gullible congregations. What is more serious, those congregations in turn cannot, on the average, have a very active faith. A majority of them must either not know the basic teachings of Christianity or else not believe in them. For surely if the congregations were largely composed of believing Christians, they would not hear subversive rant from their pulpits more than once. And they would delegate one or two men in the congregation to carry the ranter to the front door and see whether they could heave him to the other side of the street. As for the Catholics present, I shall say nothing about the explosion that is now desolating their church. And I shall merely extend my sincere sympathy to distressed men and women who 5 years ago would have thought nothing in the world more impossible than that priests of their church should publicly deny the resurrection of Christ, or that monastics teaching in a Catholic university should calmly tell their classes that, of course, they don't believe in the existence of God. So the real question is, how many Americans at the present time are Christians in the sense that they really believe in Christianity? To be specific and at the same time avoid all doctrinal differences, how many Americans can you find on the 14th of April, 1967, who really and fully believe in just three articles of faith? First, that Jesus Christ was in fact the Son of God. Second, that the soul is immortal. And third, that divine justice punishes sin and rewards virtue in a life beyond the grave. How many are really convinced of those three things? I do not know, so I ask those who have the means of making an estimate. One man, whose purity of faith and integrity cannot be doubted, and who furthermore has had an opportunity to make observations throughout the country, a man whose name would be known to and respected by all of you, says that his best estimate is that about 12% of the population of the United States is Christian in that sense. I have had more optimistic estimates from others, ranging as high as a tentative and hopeful 20%. In other words, no matter how profound and absolute your own faith may be, you must recognize that as a Christian, you are now a member of a minority. You must further recognize that given the intellectual climate of our time, the percentage of Christians is not going to increase sufficiently within the next 4 or 5 years. That is to say, within the time in which our battle will be decisively won or lost. I have great confidence in the man whose estimate was 12%, but let's take 20% as the figure. What do we have? We have a minority that has in common the need to fight for the survival of its most sacred and cherished beliefs. It is a considerable minority, and as we all know, it takes only a minority to capture a country, provided, of course, that the minority works in unison and with coordinated effort. But our 20% is not that kind of minority. It holds certain beliefs in common, but it is also divided by profound doctrinal differences that cannot be glossed over or ignored, for to ignore them is to say, in effect, that religion does not matter. We are all aware of the very deep and vital differences between Catholic, Protestant, and Mormon doctrines. These doctrines are at many points irreconcilable, and at least two out of the three must necessarily be wrong. There is nothing in the world easier than to collect a group of patriotic Christians and start among them in half an hour a three-cornered fight of impressive proportions. But you don't have to mix people from those major divisions. I need not expatiate on the acute tensions within Catholicism, on the multiplicity of Protestant denominations, or on the rivalry between the various Mormon churches. Let me remind you of one example that is still fresh in our minds. There is a group of Protestant churches, most of them small and independent, that are sometimes described as fundamentalist or evangelical. Now, some of these churches do, and some do not, hold to an interpretation of certain scriptural passages on which they base a faith which they support by some ancillary considerations, that they are, in one way or another, the descendants of the Israelites. Now, I do not comment on that article of faith any more than I comment on a belief in transubstantiation, apostolic succession, justification by faith, predestination, marriage for eternity, or any other dogma that is accepted by some and rejected by other Christian churches. I merely note that some of the fundamentalist and evangelical groups held that belief and that others did not. And that so far as I know, there was no very serious dispute or antagonism between those fundamentalist churches over that article of belief. But it took only one little pamphlet signed to the titular head of a supposedly elite patriotic organization to start a violent rumpus that is still going on. What made the pamphlet, in fact, ludicrous was that it was not the expression of a conflicting faith, for the person who signed it does not even pretend to be a Christian, although he is willing to say some nice things about Christians when he is out collecting money. The pamphlet, however, was a fairly good smear job, such as could be written by any moderately clever hack about the distinctive doctrine of any Christian sect. And now, almost 4 years later, you can still hear people asking, "Is so-and-so British Israel?" in the tones in which they might ask, "Does he peddle narcotics?" or "Is he an agent of the Defamation League?" About the article of faith that I have mentioned, many of you may feel strongly, one way or the other. If you do, you will need no further argument from me to see that such solidarity as exists among the Christian remnant in this country is at best a defensive one. And even that defensive accord can be easily broken by a clever creator of discord. To what, then, shall we look for a unifying and energizing concept? To the Constitution? All of us here, I am sure, want to see restored the constitutional republic planned by our forefathers. And we often tell one another that the republic must be restored. But can we use allegiance to that rational ideal as a means of mobilizing the latent strength of the nation? I wonder. During the past 8 years, no change has been more significant than the very rapid erosion of emotional loyalty to the most rational form of government devised by the mind of man. That Constitution, as it has been torn up and destroyed piece by piece by the Warren Gang and other subversives, has been steadily receding into the past and becoming an historical document of merely antiquarian interest in the minds of our people as a whole, and very particularly in the minds of the generation that will replace us. Unless I was mistaken 8 years ago, loyalty to the Constitutional Republic was then a force that counted. But today, back to the Constitution is a cry that will not evoke much response, except insofar as the portions of the Constitution that have not yet been thrown into the ash can may offer to the states a legal means of resisting or delaying usurpation by the scofflaws that occupy the Supreme Court and the outlaws that occupy most of the rest of Washington. Young Americans are, with few exceptions, thinking in quite different terms. If our constitutional republic is to be restored at all, the work of restoration must be done gradually over as many years as were required for the insidious and gradual work of subversion. The battle will be decided long before that. What is more, we have now passed the point at which the Constitution could be restored by constitutional means. Let me call your attention to but one example. I chose it because it would also call your attention to a point that is sometimes overlooked. How many of us have read the Constitution? I'll begin by confessing that I have not. I have read a large part of it, but I have not read all of it. I haven't been able to find anyone who has. The Constitution of these United States is not merely the text of a contract between the several states that was drafted by the Constitutional Convention. The text that you can find reprinted in almost any yearbook and can read in 20 minutes. Some of the most important parts of the Constitution are the things that are not mentioned in it, because the framers of that document simply took them for granted as presupposed by the established custom and thinking of the time. The Constitution in its way was like the contract that you made when you registered in this hotel. You agreed to pay $10 or $20 a day for a room with one or two beds in this or that part of the building. It never occurred to you to stipulate to the management that no stranger was to be sent to share your room. It never occurred to you to stipulate that you would not pay the hotel an extra charge for the water and soap supplied in the bathroom. It did not occur to you to say that you positively would not pay extra to have the linen changed and the bed made. On the other hand, it did not occur to the management to specify that you would be charged extra for meals. And yet you need not be very old or have traveled very widely to have seen hotels in which all those points were subjects for negotiation. But both you and the management of this hotel simply took it for granted that you both understand and accept the prevailing custom. One thing that the framers of the federal Constitution took for granted, of course, was the constitutions of the several states that adhered to the federal compact. So unless you have read all of those constitutions, you cannot say that you have read even the text of the Constitution. Those constitutions differed greatly, but they had some things in common. It never occurred to our founding fathers that the nation could ever deteriorate to a democracy. For every one of the contracting states imposed requirements for citizenship, and some imposed further requirements for the privilege of voting. All states imposed a property qualification, and some imposed more than that. The state of Pennsylvania, for example, under its constitution, which was adopted under the presidency and authority of Benjamin Franklin, specifically limited citizenship to Christians, requiring as the first qualification for citizenship an oath attesting belief in Jesus Christ and in the Trinity. Had a majority in our Constitutional Convention foreseen a time when the insane doctrine of one creature, one vote would prevail in the nation they were founding, they would have sent an urgent embassy to London to say, "We made an awful mistake in 1776. Please take us back." But now a very large part of our population simply takes it for granted that anything that can stand on two legs has some divine right to a vote so that it can sell that vote to the highest bidder. A constitutional republic is simply impossible without restrictions on the franchise. And let me ask you whether you seriously believe that you can arouse within the next 2 or 3 years enough enthusiasm and devotion to induce a majority of the present voters, including the vast mass of parasites now bred and maintained at your expense, for the sole purpose of canceling out your votes and so effectively disenfranchising the taxpayers. Well, do you really think you're going to persuade a majority to vote restrictions on the franchise? For that matter, don't some of you feel that it was most indiscreet of me to mention such a thing out loud? And isn't it quite likely that even among those who still profess loyalty to the Constitution, you could have a very heated discussion over the desirability of restoring that part of the Constitution? To what then shall we appeal? We all believe, I am sure, in a free economy, but can we arouse any widespread enthusiasm for that? I doubt it. For one thing, we have now passed the point of no return. 8 years ago, there was still a possibility that by prompt, drastic, and unpleasant measures, we could, if we had the power, have salvaged our national economy. But now the work of destruction plotted by the malignant mind of Franklin Roosevelt, or rather his masters, is almost complete. It is no longer possible to save the burning house. Our currency, once the soundest in the world, is now intrinsically worthless, and we are saved from declared bankruptcy only by the condescending mercy of the nations that we humbly beg, hat in hand, not to collect what we owe them. And domestically as well as internationally, we are a nation that is hopelessly bankrupt. Everyone knows that the vast bonded indebtedness of the federal government and the vast indebtedness of the state governments and the fantastic debts of municipalities, school districts, and the like will never be paid. In fact, we are very near the time at which we can no longer go on paying interest on that fraudulently contrived debt. Everyone knows that those astronomical debts will be simply repudiated, or possibly they will be paid off in dollars at a time when a bushel basket full of $10 bills will be needed to buy a package of cigarettes. And our enemies are now able to precipitate a total economic collapse at any time that they wish, to reenact on a much larger scale the comedy they rehearsed in Germany in the 1920s, when the whole of an old man's life savings would not suffice to buy a loaf of bread. Even if our enemies do not for some reason go through with their plan, control of our economy by some government for some very long period of time is now inevitable. If the most conscientiously conservative government that you can imagine were by some miracle put into power tomorrow, it would be drastic and unconstitutional powers to stave off the debacle or try to salvage something from the ruins. We have therefore become, temporarily at least, a socialist country. There is no longer anything we can do about it. Oh, it would be possible to go out and find some Fabian socialists and hang them to lampposts, but we cannot undo... But that would not undo the work that they have done. Lynching an arsonist will not restore what he has destroyed. If we are ever again to have a free economy, that will be decades in the future, after a new generation has cleared away the charred ruins of what we once had and what we did not protect. I hope that day will come, but I know that I will not live to see it. How many people still believe, really believe, in free enterprise? Few, surely. Americans for a long time entertained the comforting illusion that there was some relation between wealth and conservatism. And amazingly, they went on believing that even after they saw that the Bolshevik capture of Russia in 1917-18 had been contrived and financed by some of the largest banking houses in New York, London, Paris, Berlin, and Stockholm. The financial web spun about the Western world by those wealthy suborners of treason and anarchy has increased strand by strand, day by day, since 1918. And now the spider's web encompasses every town and hamlet. Does free enterprise mean guaranteeing to those spiders their power forever? We think not. But I challenge you to explain why it does not in less than 5 pages of very small print. Free enterprise, as Washington's powers of coercion and bribery have increased, corporation after corporation has made its compromise with the plotters and looters, often reluctantly to be sure, but when once the compromise has been accepted, it comes to seem normal. By this time, many, perhaps most, of our largest corporations depend for their very existence on the toleration which they purchase or otherwise win in Washington, and many of them depend directly on contracts from the federal government. The elimination of independent businesses that are managed by their owners continues apace. There are fewer today than there were yesterday, and there will be fewer tomorrow. In every city, every year, some established local business, which may have a specialized national market, is sold to strange purchasers who turn out to be the agents of a subsidiary of a subsidiary of a subsidiary of a corporation whose real ownership is hidden behind an impenetrable legal facade. And since one of the four major purposes of what is called foreign aid was to export American money for use by aliens to purchase control of American industries, no one can now guess what fraction of our industrial complex is still owned by Americans. Who will rally to the standard of free enterprise? Let's waste no time on questions of morality or economics. Instead, let us ask ourselves just one blunt question. Do you suppose that any considerable part of the membership of labor unions will rally to that standard? Will work and vote for the principle of free enterprise, undeterred by a fear that that will or might place them at the mercy of alien or domestic exploiters? Well, when you have made that calculation, let me remind you that without the votes of wage earners, you are not going to win any political victory. Shall we appeal to morality? There is undoubtedly in the United States a great latent, inarticulate allegiance to the concept of morality, an allegiance that is certainly wider than faith in Christianity and may well be what Prieto would call a residue. Despite the best efforts of our educators and mental health experts, the majority of the American people still believe that there is a difference between right and wrong. And they still have some fairly definite notions of what is right and what is wrong. There is a tenuous consensus on some things, but on many others there is a vast fog of uncertainty, doubt, and perplexity. Our nation has been poisoned by experts for generations. And the result, I am afraid, is the kind of paralysis of results where there is no clear and comprehensive code that is almost unanimously accepted, automatically and without argument. It is the kind of paralysis that is inevitable when a society has been befuddled with hypocritical talk that it should try to cure the criminal with love, when it has become so befuddled that it is ashamed even to admit frankly that the only perfect purpose of law is to punish the offender for his transgression. A comprehensive system of morality for a large population necessarily depends, as all history has shown time and again, on a generally accepted religion. And we've already discussed that point. Atheists sometimes claim that a specific and rigorous standard of personal conduct can be maintained without reference to religious belief by a code of honor. And they're right. That can and has been done for a certain period of time. But it has been done, as the apologists forget to remind us, only in the very limited circles of a social class that forms, in its own estimation, a kind of aristocracy. A code of honor may be a powerful social force, but it is by definition extra-legal, and it is necessarily ruthless. Let me give you just one example. During Roosevelt's war, the commander of an American naval vessel that had been hit by the Japanese and was sinking forgot the old unwritten law of the sea that provides who must be the last to leave a sinking ship. He saved himself, and he and a part of his crew survived. But when he returned to port, his fellow officers, obedient to the high and implacable code of honor, put him on silence, as the treatment is called. His presence was simply not acknowledged. He received no assignment. Superior officers could not see him. Junior officers turned their backs. There was no court-martial. He shot himself. It may not have been Christian not to forgive him, and it may have been cruel not to hear what he could have alleged in apology for his transgression. But that is the way that a military case maintains its code of honor. And without a case with such a code, no Western nation can long survive. But are we going to campaign for a code of honor on a national scale? It's fantastic. There is, as I have said, residual in the American people a strong sense that there should be moral standards. But a simple appeal to morality will not give cohesion to those sentiments and will not create the mass movement that we need. What we must do is find some way of appealing first to the large, undifferentiated, not too self-sacrificing Americans that we all know. We need not enlist a majority, but we need to enlist a sizable minority. And I am afraid that means that we must in some way show them that it is to their self-interest to move with us. We must be able to promise and mean it. We must be able to promise to wage earners that they will get more in the future, not less. We must be able to promise to professional politicians that we can give them something that they cannot get from the other side. But more than that, what we must do is find some way of appealing to the superior men of our race, and especially to the young, to the many young men and women who have partly or completely escaped from the schools with a willingness or even an eagerness to work and to sacrifice themselves for a cause that is noble, for a cause that is greater than any man, greater even than any generation of men. There are such young men and women. I do not know how many. I do not know whether there will be enough of them. But I know that they are there and that they are waiting for such a cause. There is something in them that is revolted by the dirty little cockroaches that crawl over most college campuses these days and squeak and squall. They are weary unto death of the endless babbling and the sleazy word twisting of liberal intellectuals and other professorial shysters. They are waiting for someone to raise the standard of a cause for which they live, a cause for which they can live with exultation, and for which, if need be, they will die with the heroism of our race. Here is a specimen of what I mean. It is a paper that has come to me through a series of hands, and it was written, evidently first class in English, by an undergraduate, a sophomore, I am told, at a college that I have never seen, and about which I know only the statistics that I could find in the almanac. It is not a perfect composition, but it obviously comes from the mind and heart of a young man. And I mean man, not just something that wears trousers. I wish that I could read you all of it, for the young man discusses with real perception the decadence of the West and the causes of its desperate plight. He lucidly argues that if the West is to survive, it cannot do so by what he calls, quote, the dead weight of mere masses, but must recreate a true aristocracy. I will read you the passage in which he describes that aristocracy. This bold young order will comprise not an effete social class, but a spiritualized organic rank of honor, chivalry, discipline, faith, and ironclad responsibility. The true aristocracy, as the custodian of the most advanced idea, will know itself, and while scorning false pride, will assume once again the prerogative of the ancient mead halls. to speak forthrightly of its deeds. And above all, this aristocracy will value its mission above its fate, caring little whether its next encounter will be Hermann's resounding victory in the Teutoburger Forest or Leonidas's blood-drenched martyrdom on the pass of Thermopylae, provided that the West survives. Once again, the words of Yoki ring true. The mission of this generation is the most difficult that has ever faced a Western generation. It must break the terror by which it is held in silence. It must look ahead. It must believe when there is apparently no hope. It must obey, even if it means death. It must fight to the end rather than submit. Do you feel the spirit that breathes from that composition? As I have said, I know nothing of that college. I know not who the English teacher who read that theme may have been. He was like some that I have seen. He squealed in a soprano voice, gulped down a martini, and then laughed, and may have called up his boyfriend. If he was one of the more intelligent liberals, when he read that theme, he gulped down two martinis, sat down with a pale face, and felt spreading through him a shiver, as though someone were walking over his grave. And he may have been right. There is a force latent in our youth. But you will notice the young man says nothing of a religious revival, and I cannot tell from the text whether he is a Christian or not. He says nothing about the Constitution or free enterprise. He does speak of a code of honor, but it is the code of a new knighthood. To what force can we appeal? By what force can we move both the superior young men and at the same time a large segment of our less heroic, less perceptive population? I have thought about that long and earnestly many times, and I can see but one possibility open to us. It was one that I rejected in 1960. When in my published article I commended conservative Americans for their act of moral abstention, and I remarked on the dangers, the very real and serious dangers, of calling up the whirlwind. But it is now 1967. Our plight is more desperate, and therefore the more desperate must be our expedients, and the greater the risks that we must take in our last chance for survival. So I ask once again, shall we call up the whirlwind? There is no longer a moral question, for the decision was not ours. Our enemies have invoked, aroused, and unleashed the blind and terribly potent forces that we hoped might lie quiescent. Our only choice is whether we shall use them too. We are not in the position of a nation that has to decide whether it shall use some new weapon, such as airplanes, when they were first invented, whether we shall decide whether we shall use that new weapon to attack others. We are in the position of a nation that, attacked by airplanes, has to decide whether it will use airplanes to fight back, or will prefer to go under and vanish from the earth. We must decide whether we will fight fire with fire or whether we prefer to be consumed. We are the most patient, the most long-suffering, the most generous of peoples. We certainly did not start the race war, but now that it has been started for us, it may be that we can finish it. The instinct of racial loyalty lies deep in men. Though it may be crushed over with sophistic palaver, although it may seem to have disappeared under the powder of words sprinkled over it, it remains dormant fixed in the flesh, dormant in the soul, and it will awaken when that crust is broken. Race is the one thing that we all have in common. It is an obvious and inescapable bond of unity between us, a unity that transcends theological distinctions and even belief and unbelief. It is an immediate reality, not an ideal lost in the past and to be recovered, if at all, only after years. The instinct of race is part of whatever self-respect and pride is left in us. And as we are coming to realize, it is becoming a matter of survival. It is the strongest emotional force that can be aroused in man, for it appeals to the deepest and most primitive emotions. No man of the West wishes to see his wife or daughter raped, and no man of the West, to speak of a highly unpleasant matter that is forcing itself into the public consciousness only now as we have more and more integrated schools, no man of the West wishes to see his son raped. And now, as you have become aware, if you have seen the last week's issue of the excellent newspaper that is published in this city, the Birmingham Independent, race has at last become a matter of immediate economic self-interest to our entire wage-earning population, our entire working population. It is an interest that is common to the most poorly paid laborer and to the most highly paid executive. For no workman wishes to be thrown from his job, however humble, to make way for a Negro. And no executive wishes to be relegated to a menial position to make way for a Jew, as the Jews in their folly are now openly demanding. An edict from the despotism in Washington abolishing seniority and merit in all private employment to make way for our sacrosanct minority races may well be the last insult and outrage that we, the world's only creative minority, will stand. Maybe that Edouard Drumont was right in 1819 when he predicted that there would come at last a point beyond which we, our race, cannot be insulted and cuffed and spat upon with impunity. We are strange people, we men of the West. We like to hesitate, examine our consciences, make sure that we are just and more than just, and even make sure that our enemies will not be harmed unnecessarily. I am not discussing those things now. I am only telling you that so far as I can discover, this is your last weapon, and that it may possibly, just possibly, be one that will avert an otherwise certain and unspeakably terrible defeat. It is, of course, not a thing that is to be put into use immediately and flamboyantly by rushing out into the streets in 15 minutes and shouting. This is a suggestion of strategy, something to be planned for, something towards which efforts should converge. I do not urge or recommend. The choice is one of such gravity and fraught with such risks that each man must choose for himself. He must consider and weigh very carefully the alternatives before him. And then he must make his decision for himself, make it alone and undisturbed, in earnest meditation, in the sacred and silent chapel of his own soul.